I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Are we humans facing an apocalypse? We're wondering in part two of our series. One answer from our scientists this hour might be, come back and look in, say, the year 2300. You won't recognize your descendants.
I think most people who are familiar with evolution nonetheless somehow think that we humans are the end of a story. We're the culmination of it all. No astronomer could believe that.
I think the chance that humanity will survive as we have known it for a very long time is essentially zero. We're mutating genetically, but we're also developing technologies that allow ourselves to change ourselves. And it's pretty likely that we'll take up some of them before too long.
We do need to move through this technological age, but we also need to maintain that humanity. We are all afraid of becoming robots. I don't necessarily need to be smarter. I just want to be self-actualized.
Well, this whole cluster of technologies, reading and writing genomes, is going so fast that it's hard to maintain the expertise at the highest levels. The technology that we predicted would take 6 decades to bring down the price of, say, reading a human genome from billions of dollars to $1,000, instead it took like 8 years. And so that's the sort of thing that sneaks up on you really fast, yeah.
The worries of the world we're just entering are new in all time. Bricks, mortar, construction codes of human life, all the cells that define our talents and traits are suddenly transparent to human science. Not just transparent, but wide open to manipulation and redesign. It feels like news that's going to stay news, as Siddhartha Mukherjee writes in his big new intimate history of the gene. We have invented technologies that allow us to change human genomes intentionally and permanently, Mukherjee says, for all the generations to come. In this second hour of a series, we're lurking in the black shadows of genius-level science, listening for the whispers of apocalypse. Why, for starters, has President Obama's chief of intelligence, James Clapper, put the gene editing revolution on his worldwide watch list among weapons of mass destruction? Genetic modification is the hottest and richest young industry in university world. It's a sort of bullet train in largely unseen research tunnels, soon to burst forth with a vast array of choices and implications. Cancer proofing, perhaps. Steep cuts in the incidence of Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, Huntington's diseases. Longer lifespans, fairer skins, of course, and sharper aptitudes of every kind. But for whom? At what price? On whose say-so? All still to be discussed. And at what risk? So Dr. Mukherjee gets us started. Indian-born, a Rhodes Scholar from Stanford, medical doctor and cancer researcher from the Harvard Medical School, still young at 46. Dr. Mukherjee won the Pulitzer Prize 5 years ago for his biography of cancer, The Emperor of All Maladies, and he's just published a second celebrated tome on the gene. The new book has him all through it. The crushing mental diseases that broke two of his uncles and a first cousin and forced the question, why? What part of the family madness came out of crazy-making partition time in India as the British were leaving in 1947? What part was and might still be in the Mukherjee family code?
I grew up in a family which was comprised of my father, my sister, my mother, and I. And my grandmother came to live with us with my father's uncle, who was progressively becoming schizophrenic. And we had to deal with that idea. And as a child, it was something that it was very much part of my consciousness. We were very close. And then as I began to sort of look through it, parse through it, it became clear that my uncle was not the only one afflicted. During my childhood, one of my cousins from the same part of the family was institutionalized. And as I found out, another uncle had been severely afflicted by what seems now like bipolar disorder. So there was that history sort of looming in the front and the back. Every part of your consciousness as a child suddenly becomes part of that history. My father in particular was in denial about it for a long time, but it was impossible to deny. There was a grown man mentally ill living with us as children, and my grandmother's, the last morsels of her energy were spent tending to her sick child. So as I grew older, I became a cancer biologist and an internist. It was very clear that this history needed to be exhumed in some way and understood.
Yeah.
And for me, that process took a long time as we began to find out that there are genetic components to schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. These genetic components actually are being increasingly discovered, and they're increasingly part of our lives.
And now you're a famous scientist at the top of a profession which can imagine the elements that enable disease.
Most of my patients have leukemia and blood cancer syndromes. I would say 50 to 60% of those patients we are getting genetic sequence for. So reading their genomes, trying to figure out if that reading process is going to help us devise particular treatments for them. Once in a while during that reading process, we'll discover that maybe there's a familial component to this, that maybe there's a chance that they will pass on. It's rare, but they will pass on a leukemia-like disease to their children, in which case we need to begin to have another conversation with them to ask the question, you know, there's a possibility that we need to test your children or your children's children. This is what's happening in my own practice, a kind of prediction of fate. And of course, in the background, I'm constantly thinking, how quickly will we know or how quickly will we understand what genes increase the risk of mental illness, schizophrenia? Will I get tested? Should I? I'll give you the quandary. You have two children, say. Let's say you find a gene variant that increases the risk of a devastating illness, let's say schizophrenia, by 10%, 15%. Those are the limits of prediction. You don't know more than that. You don't know whether this will be unveiled by some environmental trigger. You don't know whether it will be unveiled by another genetic influence that we don't know. And now, to play this out with me, let's say now you test yourself, but more importantly, you have two children, you test both your children, and only one of them carries the risk. Nothing's happened. The world has not changed, and yet your world has permanently changed. Your relationship to that child may have changed permanently. What does it mean? What is the sort of psychosocial aspects, ethical, moral aspects of knowing one of your two children carries a heightened risk, even if that risk is predicted as heightened by 10%? Does it change your relationship? If we enter the era of deep genetic annotation and sequencing, which we rapidly are, these are the quandaries that we will face more and more.
So you're speaking now as historian and scientist and parent. I want to hear the voices inside that say, one of them must say, plunge, do something. There's another one who's got to be saying, be careful.
These voices are very much voices in my head as a scientist, as a clinician, as a cancer biologist, as a cancer doctor, and just as you pointed out, as a father and nephew and son of a family where genetic illnesses has been sort of marked with a red line. So I characterize my own feelings about this as somewhere in the middle. Those two voices are simultaneously in my head. One voice that says, read the genome and let's try to move forward with the technologies that allow us to powerfully push forward and potentially have an impact on devastating genetic illnesses. The other voice in my head is a physician's voice, which is to say, first, do no harm. And if the principles should be first, do no harm, then how much technology do we need to know about before we decide to do no harm or we decide to move forward? So the physician's voice, the personal voice, the family's voice, the father's voice, and the son's voice are all simultaneously ringing bells in my mind, as they are in the minds of many, many other people.
That's a marvelous introduction, it seems to me, to the whole thing. And then you look around in this moment, 2016, it's a gold rush. It's a historic scientific moment, maybe a historic turn in the life of the human species after all these years. What do you see?
Well, the first thing I see is that we need to have another major conversation about what to do and what not to do concerning human genomes and potentially animal genomes. The vocabulary needs to be established. Bateson, one of Mendel's bulldogs, one of the people who revived this idea that had sort of floundered away from the 1860s to the 1900s, an important scientist, actually coined the word genetics, says that sooner or later, he's writing in the 1900s, sooner or later, some power will discover how powerful it is to manipulate genes, and then the world will not be the same again. We are in that world. The metaphor of danger and power, of desire for emancipation versus the threat of unintended consequences.
It sounds like Oppenheimer looking at the first nuclear mushroom cloud. What did we learn from man-made creation in an emergency of a doomsday machine? How much do the bio guys know about the nuclear history, and how much should they know?
It's very important to have the atomic scientists in this conversation. The general history, summarized very beautifully, by the way, in Richard Rhodes' book, The Making of the Atomic Bomb, should be required reading for all biologists. Spectacular book. We've learned that there have been rogue attempts to try to access the technology. We've learned that it's led to proliferation by powerful actors around the world. It's not been contained to the first world. It's been diffused through now multiple countries. We've learned that those reactors are generally safe, but when they are subject to environmental disaster, such as in Fukushima, that they can release incredible amounts of harm into the world. Every single one of those lessons is relevant. The two ringing voices, the pro voice and the con voice, should be ringing in our heads simultaneously. So with atomic energy, we were talking about a physical form of energy released into the world. With changing the human genome, we're talking about a machine that learns its own instructions, a machine that learns to decode and change its own instructions. We haven't done that in history. Even the knowledge that you can do that as a machine changes the machine itself. Even the knowledge that you can change or read and write your own instructional code will change forever who you are. That's where we are today.
Siddhartha Mukherjee's thoroughly readable history and guide to genetics today is The Gene. On the Rio Olympics, he gave us a scientist's and a fan's reflection on the mix of diversity and virtuosity on display. Check it out at our website, radioopensource.org. Coming up, we're in the lab with the MD biologist George Church, bold captain of Harvard's gene editing team. He's getting famous for thinking about the long game, like bringing back the woolly mammoth from 100 centuries of extinction with some frozen DNA. This is Open Source. The outsized majesty of George Church starts with his address at the Harvard Medical School on Avenue Louis Pasteur, named for the germ hunter, father of pasteurization and vaccinations in 19th century Paris. Inside the lab, centrifuges, pipettes, postdocs.
So these are the wet benches, so where people would work.
They're centrifuging tubes, like pelleting cells at the bottom of them. They are running gels, separating sizes of DNA. They're reconstructing a woolly mammoth genome from an elephant genome.
And then there's the man inside the church lab, bearded, the size of a football lineman, woolly and mammoth, like the prehistoric beast he means to revive. Accessible in person, George Church is direct in his language about cures, side effects, risks, and Murphy's Law that hangs over every adventurer. He makes easy conversation with Stephen Colbert these days, and with me too. I said, I picture you on the frontier of an alternate universe of the customized genome. And I wonder why in the world you'd want to cross into that territory.
You don't ask permission of your great-great-grandchildren if it's okay with them if you change humanity. So, for example, smallpox is something where nobody gets it today, but you know, my granddaughter did not have a say in that. She did not get the vote on whether we were going to eliminate smallpox from the world.
And what risks do you see out there in tweaks, cumulative tweaks?
I see risks everywhere with every new technology. I mean, I see risks with automobiles. 1 million people die every year from automobiles. And I try to bring all the new risks of biotechnologies to everyone's attention years in advance, or at least at much advanced notice as the cutting-edge technologists can see. Hmm. So almost every new technology is worthy of everybody engaging in a technical conversation and an ethical conversation about why it gives us the shivers and what to do about it. Hmm. And if our gut feeling is it's going to go forward one way or another, it's much better to do it out transparently in the open rather than driving it underground where only the rich or the evil are doing it. You know, we need to do a lot of safety and efficacy testing where the USDA, the EPA, and the FDA are all engaged.
You left out the CIA, and I mentioned it because James Clapper, who is President Obama's Director of National Intelligence, in his annual worldwide threat assessment this year,
he classified
has gene editing on the list of WMDs.
Right.
Weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah.
What does he not know, or what does he know maybe that you don't?
He didn't technically call it a weapon of mass destruction. It was just in the category of items of concern that could be dual use, including of WMDs. Some of my colleagues felt that he was overstating it and scaring. But the reason that it should be listed is that it's rare that you get something that is so rapidly changing, so transformative, and so inexpensive. So basically, you know, we have high school students that are engineering with CRISPR. So I think it merits due consideration. If that requires putting it on the dual use list, then let's do that.
I'm fascinated to hear you say that you know a number of people, maybe hundreds, who are working on their own genome. Sooner or later, we get there where everybody can do it.
So it is already do-it-yourself. There are DIY bio groups all over the world. They're reading their own genome. There are a million people that have access to their own genome at the most basic level. And that number is growing and upgrading to full genome sequences.
What are people doing with it?
The two most significant things, I think, underappreciated. A lot of people are not joining the revolution, and I think it's to their own detriment. If you're planning on having children, or even if you're the age where you might accidentally have a child, you should know whether you're a carrier for disease, because you can either use it for dating information. In other words, you can exclude a very tiny fraction of the population who has exactly the same thing you have, and then marry based on love within this very large collection of people that are genetically compatible. Or you can do it, as most people do it, later, once you're already married, and you find that you're both carriers. But then the options are typically, you know, adoption, abortion, or in vitro fertilization, none of which are particularly great options relative to, say, deciding before you're married. But all of these are options if you know your genome. And the other thing that you can do with your genome, your past reproductive decision making, is avoiding certain cancers. So this is preventative medicine. It is not reactive, which is most of cancer. And Angelina Jolie was, you know, a very public figure for this, where she learned about her genome and found that she was at risk for breast cancer and had double mastectomy and ovarectomies. And this is not because she found the lump in her breast or had a mammogram, but because of a very high risk factor, changing her risks from 87% down to 5% by having the preventative surgeries.
That was a gutsy move, and she was celebrated for it. But we've entered the world of eugenics. The thought of a disease-free human being, or a, say, cancer-proof human being, gives you pause. Do we want to go there?
Well, a cancer-free body, I don't think, should be confused with eugenics. I think very few people would object to being cancer-free for life and dying of something else, or even having a slightly longer youth than we currently have. Becoming cancer-resistant doesn't involve eugenics. I think the real crime in eugenics, time and again, and this was not a German phenomenon, this was the United States and Scandinavia and many countries. In fact, it was still practiced in the 1970s in the United States, well after World War II. The crime was involuntary sterilization, where I think 60 or 70,000 people in the United States alone were sterilized without their permission. I think today, if we were to label parents making decisions about the health of their baby, so that, let's say, Tay-Sachs is a very severe disease, it's been almost eliminated in certain populations that practice genetic counseling, as we all should, that is the parent's right. Now, you might say some parents make poor choices for their children and without consulting their children. But if that were the case, then we should be passing laws preventing parents from homeschooling, tattooing their babies, and, you know, who knows what all else. That's not our practice in the United States anyway.
Speak of three risks that come to my mind. One is this eugenics one, what get to be called Hitler babies, perfect specimens of the old species that create, in effect, a new humanity and break the idea of a single species.
I think it's unlikely that there is a perfect human, just like there's not the case that we have a perfect means of transportation, right? I mean, you know, you've got cars, you've got jets, you've got big oil tankers. The diversity is what's important, and that's the lesson we learn from evolution as well. A species is in trouble the less diverse it is, and the more rapidly changing the environment is. We have a rapidly changing environment. We better be diverse. We better get off the planet. That's going to require additional diversity. So if anything, we want to increase diversity, not decrease. So that perfect person, I think, is not a reasonable concept. What was the second one?
Breaking the unity of
species. So, you know, will we become two species? Again, this is partly an egalitarian thing, but let's say it were cheap enough that everybody could afford it. But nevertheless, some people decide not to have it. So it's a decision rather than involuntary speciation. You could argue that, you know, that happens. I mean, you have people who dress up differently because they don't want to be tempted by other people. They want to live, you know, a Mennonite camp. They don't want to live with everybody else. Or they want to dress like goth, you know, all black with skin piercings and so forth, so that they will be a separate culture. Even not a separate species, but for all intents and purposes.
When they get over their goth phase, In this case, they're going to be changed forever. And their kids will be changed.
We haven't gotten over the Mennonite, you know, in the many subcultures that choose generation after generation to stay separate. Now, that said, I think it's very hard to create a new species, especially if you have a free society where people can breed however they want. You'd have to do that intentionally, and there'd be a great deal of discussion about it. It's not sufficient to have blonde hair to become a new species. Hmm. Now, maybe if we went to Mars and very intentionally said, oh, we need a whole new set of traits in order to survive on Mars or in the vacuum and zero gravity of space, maybe that would happen, but there'd probably be reasons for it, and it would be subject to a great deal of discussion. It's not something we're going to slip into easily from our current vantage point.
Somebody going to cook it up in a garage?
What you can do in the garage is getting, there's more power to the individual, which is a little scary. I've asked for higher levels of surveillance for people that are doing this right now. But I think for the time being, it's warranted to have something that goes beyond voluntary transparency and disclosure of what you're doing. It should also be involuntary surveillance of anybody who is an expert in all fields of synthetic biology. I think that deserves scrutiny during this transition phase.
Second general zone, and we've touched on it, but is the whole matter of tampering with the code of nature, fiddling with mosquitoes to get rid of the Zika virus, but not quite knowing in the third, ninth, 11th generation what the effect will be. A lot of doctors will tell you, we have no idea about the interaction of the drugs that people take, and they can be dangerous, but neither do we have much idea of into the third generation, as you speak about.
And one of the things that worries me that I've mentioned publicly from the beginning is if everybody had access to this new technology and they could target any organism, everybody has their hit list. And if you just allowed them to do it without any surveillance, without any regulation, there wouldn't be that many species left because everybody, you know, has some, they don't like water hyacinths or spiders or ticks or, you know, and pretty soon you've got a serious problem. Ants, you want to draw the line. So you need to focus on things that are serious public health threats and make sure that your impact on the ecosystem is insignificant.
You sound pretty sure of it, and you sound as if you really considered it in the round, I must say, which I think is something people say about you, George Church, that you're a very balanced, open, sane sort of guy, and they mean it as a compliment. But I've also wondered, and I've asked other gene scientists, do the bio guys lack a sort of tragic gene, or even the Murphy's Law gene, that everything that can go wrong will go wrong?
I'm a firm believer in Murphy's Law.
Really?
And that's part of the reason that I bring up, and my team brings up, all the negative consequences way in advance, as far in advance as we can see. And we're in a good position to do that because we're at the cutting edge.
There's a difference here that strikes me with the nuclear scientists, the famous ones like Oppenheimer, Sakharov, and the ones I knew, George Kistiakowsky, and Philip Morrison, wore those long faces till their deaths. I mean, what have we done? I just came across an Albert Einstein, Bertrand Russell manifesto, 1950, right after the war, 5 years after Hiroshima. The experts who know the most are the most gloomy, not the bio guys. I wonder how we account for that, that the bio guys are very gung-ho, careful, meticulously scientific, and at the same time, they've got a bomb in their hands, and have they thought through these unimaginable consequences?
I don't think that there's a significant difference in optimism or gloominess in biologists versus physicists. A lot of us are trained in both. I'm a biophysicist originally. I think that I would have been considerably more gloomy if I had been involved in nuclear weapons. Even if I had had a balanced portfolio where I was doing good with nuclear power, I think I would be depressed working on weapons, even if I knew that it was leading to 70 years of peace, which they didn't know in advance was going to be the outcome. I think with biology, the reason there's a little bit more enthusiasm, maybe a lot, is that most of it is aimed at positive. It doesn't depend on a very speculative policy of mutual assured destruction. I mean, we knew that nuclear power even was intrinsically dangerous. While biotechnologies, reading and writing genomes, is not intrinsically dangerous, it can be made dangerous. But even the most peaceful uses of nuclear were dangerous. You know, we knew that just picking a crack in the wall of a nuclear reactor was going to be dangerous, while a crack in a gene therapy hospital clinic is not going to be dangerous. That's almost certain. So I think that there's a reason why there's a difference in gloom between people who are developing even peaceful uses of nuclear technology versus peaceful uses of genetic technology.
Come back to a basic point, George. You've spoken of cures, remedies, medical uses, Alzheimer's, Tay-Sachs disease. Then comes the proactive adventures, and especially with the human mind. When will we know enough to think about tweaking human intelligence? Obviously a multi-gene sort of product. When, in your imagination, could biologists match it and extend it or control the impulse to play with it?
Yeah, well, some biologists will say that it's hopelessly complicated. But the fact is, with mice, we have done that. You know, with one or two or three genes, you can greatly improve their ability at a variety of learning tasks and performance and even anxiety. So these things that seem like they're hopelessly complex still have things you can, in the same way that human height is an incredibly complex set of genes and thousands of genes and environmental components. Nevertheless, you can influence it with a single gene, which is the growth hormone. And that's the basis of a variety of medical therapies as well. You have a huge impact on somebody's height with that one gene. So I think that we need to be cautious to not be reassured that because it's complex, we can't control it. Then it becomes, would we want to control it? Is it augmentation that's off the table, or is it the augmentation that we want the most? We, not meaning all people, but enough people that it becomes commercially viable and legislatively viable. If enough people want it, it's very rare for democratic societies to ban it.
Just generally, this word enhancement, it's so delicate. Enhancement in sports means doping. Enhancement in interrogation means torture. Enhancement in the human mind, it's robot stuff, roboticizing the human being in some fashion. No?
It's one way, yeah. We are incredibly enhanced. I find it possibly short-sighted to draw a sharp line between enhancement by something that's heritable that involves silicon and something that's heritable that involves carbon. I mean, I think they're both heritable, and my granddaughter will very likely inherit my level of education, which is something we did to ourselves. We did to our family without their permission. We educated them. You can't take that away. I mean, they can stop getting educated at some age where they become self-aware and independent, but they can't take away everything they've learned up to that point that enabled them to make that decision to stop getting educated. So I think that genetics is just one of many things, many mind games that can create inequalities or start to eliminate those inequalities depending on what we as political citizens decide to do. If we decide to provide education to everybody very seriously rather than the way we're currently doing, which is kind of half-hearted, then that might have a huge impact.
And you're not a worrier exactly, but on the George Church list of three big ones, what's on your mind?
Well, I'm worried quite a bit about asteroids and supervolcanoes. because these are things that if we don't do something about them, they could wipe out the entire human race. And I think that's a good reason for developing the physical and biological technologies we need to get colonies off the planet. I think that's the bit of diversity. Diversity is kind of a recurring theme. That's our safety net, is getting us to have geographical, neural, genetic diversity all over our solar system and beyond. That's our protection. I think pandemics, emerging diseases, we've been lucky the last few, Ebola, SARS, swine flu, those weren't as big a deal as we thought they were, but the next one could be. Just look at the movie Contagion if you want really a worst case scenario. Number three, complex societal norms. As we get to be a more homogeneous society and we're exchanging information at this high clip, will we jump onto some fad that is extremely bad for us?
Like
Nazism or Trumpism or something like that. We collectively do something very stupid.
As Harvard's main man in genetics, George Church has posted a trove of his work, his thinking, and his genome online. There's a specially good video interview with him at edge.org. Coming up, philosopher Michael Sandel draws the line that a lot of people trip on between reading the genome and writing it, between offense and defense, so to speak, between fighting disease and enhancing our venerable single species. Also, the virus warrior Pardis Sabeti, rehumanized, she testifies, by two apocalypses that nearly destroyed her. This is Open Source. Michael Sandel's field in philosophy is the core of human values, justice, fairness, the human flourishing of families and communities. 10 years ago, before most of us could spell genetic engineering, Michael Sandel wrote a dense little book called The Case Against Perfection and an Atlantic Magazine article that made it quite simple. Interventions in the genome to fight disease? Yes. To improve the human stock? No.
Genetic engineering to enhance
the intelligence, the strength, the life prospects of at least certain among us, that would, if anything, express and ratchet up what I think is a smug and ultimately damaging kind of hubris, that those who land on top are there due to their own doing, and therefore they deserve it. And those who wind up at the bottom, well, even if it's not their fault, they're unfit. This was a term from the old eugenics. They're unfit and therefore in need of eugenic repair. Eugenics, traditional eugenics, Hitler gave it a bad name, and we think of eugenics as state-coerced attempts to control or to improve the so-called gene pool, the human stock, to use these crude expressions. Eugenics is actually making a comeback, but without the element of state coercion. What we have today is the prospect of privatized or free market eugenics, where parents or those parents who can afford it may be able to pick and choose the genetic traits of their children. So the question is, what was wrong with the old eugenics? Was it only the element of state coercion? Or was it also the attempt, the hubris, to try to shape the genetic characteristics of future generations? If it's the second, then privatized free market eugenics bears a certain connection with what was morally troubling with the old-fashioned kind.
Dare we call it arrogance, Michael? You quote in your book Margaret Sanger saying, probably in the 20s or 30s, that more of the fit and fewer of the unfit is the whole plan of family planning.
Yes.
Sounds pretty spooky all this time later.
It is. And what's striking, you look back at the history of eugenics in the 20th century, it didn't start with Hitler and Nazi eugenics.
Started with Teddy Roosevelt.
Teddy Roosevelt, Margaret Sanger. It was a progressive movement of reform for the sake of uplifting, through the science of genetics, humanity. And this optimism was bound up with a certain kind of hubris. And we see both the optimism and the hubris today, even when eugenics is, so to speak, privatized, a product of the market rather than of state control.
Michael Sandel, the scientists know that they are right at a turning point here where speciation is a possibility. Some of them like it, some not. But the notion of breaking the single species definition of humanity, as George Church said, you might need some tweaks in this animal to make it adaptable to Mars, and we are going to have to colonize the rest of the solar system. How do you feel about this ambition to design a better animal?
A few years ago, in a class I co-teach with a science colleague of mine, Douglas Melton, we had James Watson in as a guest to discuss these issues. And he listened to the kinds of objections I've just been describing to eugenics, to genetic enhancement. And he said, actually, the best way to help the poor, those who lack intelligence, is to try to repair them genetically, to enhance them. One of the students said, well, if we're concerned about the poor and the disadvantaged, why don't we try to change the system of rewards that the economy bestows on different roles? Wouldn't that be a better way? And his answer was, we're never going to change that. We're never going to be able to change the economy and the way certain roles are rewarded. Better to use science. That struck me as a counsel of despair that distracts us from trying to repair the world and devotes all of our energies instead in trying to repair, so to speak, ourselves. That seems to me the wrong way around.
One of the basic differences I hear, Michael, is the response immediately to the idea of the transhuman, the idea that we could be moving toward a technologically improved or focused or differentiated species. And some people think, oh, that's the end. Or other people think, like the astronomer Martin Rees saying, there are 6 billion years yet to go in the life of this solar system. You can't imagine that it's not going to change radically. So how do you respond to this very, very telltale word, transhuman?
I think it's important to retain the distinction between human purposes and ends, contestable, subject of reflection, debate, argument, and the tools, the machines, the technologies by which we would realize those purposes and ends. So if transhumanism means the ultimate effacement of the distinction between our machines and ourselves, it would have the effect of turning us into tools, into objects, rather than enabling us to be agents or authors of purposes and ends.
Don't we all fret, though, Michael, that we've crossed that line? Sociologically, we are a divided species, and the genetic distinction is just one more confirmation that we will be two classes, new and improved, and the old folk.
The question is whether we should try to inscribe these deep inequalities biologically. Something similar is true when people say, well, if parents create so-called designer children, they're really only trying to do what hyperparents, conscientious parents, do already, to gain every competitive edge they can for their children. And aren't we already doing this? But that, it seems to me, is not an argument in favor of genetic enhancement of children. That, it seems to me, is an argument to critically reflect on the child-rearing practices and attitudes to which at least some in our society already are drifting.
As you speak about it, Michael, I'm wondering, what's the prospect of the vast majority that gets the old virtues in a way and the limits rising up against the enhancement of the species by an already enormously privileged imperial 1 or 2% that's driving it?
I think, Chris, it's an open question. And it's one of the most important open questions, morally speaking, of contemporary social and political life. People intuitively see this, feel this, but sometimes science races ahead at such a pace that moral understanding struggles to catch up. Mm. I think we're in that moment now.
Michael Sandel teaches a popular course on justice at Harvard. He's got a big following in China for his talks on spiritual hunger there and here. He says none of his books have generated stronger interest than the 10-year-old Case Against Perfection. Finally, this hour, when the Ebola virus and panic broke out in Liberia and Sierra Leone, the young gene biologist at the Broad Institute in Cambridge, born Iranian, Harvard-educated Pardis Sabeti, won laurels and a New Yorker profile for valor, first as a scientist analyzing the viruses that were being flown to her lab from West Africa every day, and then as a doctor face-to-face with Ebola and its victims.
We had been working in Sierra Leone for a number of years, and when we learned about the first cases in Guinea, we were frightened. We know those borders are porous. We know that those countries are in close contact, and that if it's in Guinea and Liberia, that it would easily come to Sierra Leone. And as the only hospital in the country that was really equipped to deal with viral hemorrhagic fevers like Ebola, we thought we could see cases. And so we immediately flew out to Sierra Leone, brought diagnostics, began to do surveillance. That definitely felt, I don't know if to say apocalyptic, but cataclysmic for sure. The World Cup was sort of like looming, and all of the world's attention was to those things. And the rest of us were just going crazy saying, like, don't you all see? You know, this could be cataclysmic, what we're dealing with here. And so we ended up doing a lot of work to try to get data out immediately. But we also were making phone calls to congressmen and having conversations with them, writing reports for the Presidential Committee on Science, trying to get as much attention as we could. We went down to D.C. to just talk to people and say, this is happening. This is far worse than you're imagining, and we need to respond right away.
I got to ask you, you met the Sheikh Umar Khan, who leapt out of those news stories to me as the kind of modern embodiment of the Dr. Rieu in Camus' Plague. But this kind of saint is some sort of a classic man against death or something, healer against death.
This is a man who took his job at Kenema Government Hospital because the person who had his job beforehand had died. Right, of Lassa virus, of the disease he was studying at the time. So very few people want to step into that role. But really his passion was to be in Sierra Leone, to move that country forward in every way possible. And he's just an extraordinary person. And you can see that light in him. You know, he was the only doctor there for a period of time dealing with 80 patients with Ebola. One patient with Ebola will take an entire hospital in the United States, like, out. Imagine that you're one doctor with 80 people, you know, with Ebola. And the one thing I also want to say is, while Dr. Khan is unique and exceptional, we see this character, these individuals who are so committed to service everywhere across the outbreak response, right? Hundreds of healthcare workers lost their lives, and many of the nurses at our hospital, you know, became infected knowing the risks that they were taking.
Bring genetic science into it, Pardis. You come armed with this insight into the genetic dimension of both the cure and the problem. How do you see it differently from the way we do, civilians, knowing that there's a gene structure in here somehow and you've got to dope it out?
Why I'm so motivated is I think that there's an extraordinary potential for science to do good in this world and for us to have the upper hand against viruses. We have all of the tools in place where we could do so. I find that the science is actually there. Sometimes the people get in the way. These viruses are these tiny things with very small genomes. We can actually learn everything about their genomes with good sequencing data. We can develop diagnostics that are sensitive to all of them. We could develop vaccines. We have the potential to identify, to prevent, to treat these viruses. There's no need for us to just, you know, hope. We can actually do something very dramatic here with science.
What's the assignment for this vast new human science?
Microbial genetics is in its deep infancy. We don't really even understand the landscape of microbes that infect us or where or how. it's one thing if we're just trying to fight off natural infection, but at the same time, there is a very real possibility that this will be man-made.
How would it happen, a man-made pathogen of really lethal proportions?
I don't even have to guess how it would happen. In February 2001, when the Human Genome Project was first described and published, there's an article that came out in the Journal of Virology by Jackson and his lab. This is in Australia. They were trying to develop ways of controlling the pest population. So Australia has a lot of pests. They basically created a version of the mousepox virus that had within it interleukin-4, which is the immune gene of the mouse. So that virus, when it entered the mouse, was able to then shut down the immune system and override, you know, everything, and basically decimated the populations of the mice that they tested it on. Well, there are many ways that we can modify viruses to make them more lethal or to change their properties. And it's getting increasingly easy for anyone to do that with fewer and fewer resources.
Could we handle another Ebola scare, especially if it were weaponized, if it were up to no good?
I think we would be much better prepared than we were when Ebola began. So we learned a lot. There's a lot of lessons learned in that process. But I do not believe that the world is prepared for something of the sort of lethality of Ebola and the infectivity of influenza. There's always a possibility of something that's very dangerous that goes airborne. And that really changes the dynamic a lot, because things that are spread in air, it's really hard to contact trace. It's really hard to isolate. We have to move towards a better response system. Hmm. We need to create a better global surveillance system. And we need to think about ways that we could head those things off when they come. And that's the kind of thing that my lab spends most of our time thinking about.
I'd love to hear your fantasy list of objectives, including, say, curing malaria, mm-hmm. or extending the life of people, or evening the availability of treatment, or you name it, make people taller, shorter, darker.
Happier. That would be the
most
important thing.
Yeah, let's talk about it. Okay. More intelligent, wiser, saner.
You know, it's always interesting to think, well, what are my values? What do I care about? And I haven't quite fixed on where I stand on these things. I mean, I do think technology is moving, and I happen to love the movie Contact with Jodie Foster. There's a scene where she's being interviewed to go and meet another life form, this alien species that reached out to the human race, and one person's allowed to go and speak to them, and she's being interviewed to be one of those people. And she's asked the question, if you had one question, a single question you could ask this new life form, what would you say? And her answer was, how did you make it through this technological age without destroying yourself? And that's a huge, powerful question. Sometimes some of the most powerful things come from popular culture, and it's always stuck with me. That's a huge question. And so I think my overarching goal would be that we move through this technological age without destroying ourselves, by making ourselves better and fairer and happier and productive, but in really positive ways.
Paradis is fascinating, probably because it sounds so human in a world and a profession that's going transhuman so fast.
You know, I had an accident recently where I shattered my pelvis and both of my knees, spent the better part of the last year in a hospital bed. I have been humanized in every which way, and I am knocked into the present, and I'm in my body all the time. And so I'm a scientist who lives in my body, whose body speaks to me sometimes more than my mind. We do need to move through this technological age, but we also need to maintain that humanity. We are all afraid of becoming robots. I mean, I love the physical therapy work that I do every day. I like the movement that I have. I don't necessarily need to be smarter. I just want to be self-actualized.
Paradis Sabeti, there is a light in you, and thank you for sharing it with us, really.
Thank you very much.
We close with Paradis for the human touch and for the reminder of St. Paul's line to the Romans that we glory in tribulations also, knowing that tribulation worketh patience, and patience experience, and experience hope. Paradis Sabeti is back full-time on the Zika case at the Broad Institute in Kendall Square, Cambridge. At Harvard, she teaches the introductory course on genetics for biology majors. Next time, will we be lucky enough to make it to the apocalypse?
Thank you, Michael Sandel, George Church, and Siddhartha Mukherjee. Our show is produced by Original Species, Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, and Frank Horton. George Hicks is our centrifuge. Mary McGrath runs our lab. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.